All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a Chief Warrant Officer, helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969. I want to welcome you to our program today. We're really excited. We've got some great guests coming on to talk about the President's decision over the last week or so to pull our troops out of Syria and move them to Iraq, as I heard on the news just now. So we're going to be talking with a number of guests about that, including Rebecca Grant later on in the second half of the program. And at the beginning, we're going to be talking with Major General Dana Pictard and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant, who wrote the book about the caliphate that we had on the program a couple of weeks ago. So we're going to kind of get up to date about that. First of all, though, I want to make sure that we thank our sponsors, because without them, we would never even have a program any longer. So with that, number one on the list is Legal Help for Veterans, and they are specializing in veterans disability claims, and that's all that they do. So for more information, go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com, or give them a call at 800-693-4800. That's Legal Help for Veterans. And number two on the list is U.S. Wings, and U.S. Wings is the manufacturers of the finest leather flight jackets in the world. U.S. Wings is a major supplier of leather flight jackets to the military. So for more information, go to their website, that's uswings.com, or give them a call at 800-650-0659. A real quick announcement about U.S. Wings. They have a product that's coming out that we are going to be giving away on the last show in November. So write down on your calendar now. The last Sunday in November, we're going to have a drawing for their Top Gun jacket. You know that the Top Gun 2 is going to be coming out shortly, and they have a special leather flight jacket that is based on the one in the movie, or maybe they provided it to the movie. I'm not sure. But this jacket runs anywhere from $600 to $800, depending on the size that you want. You can go to their website, uswings.com, and check it out on your own. But we need you to register for this. And so we need you to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and there's a prominent display picture of the jacket right there. Click on there and register. This is a brand new contest, I guess you could say, and so we need you to re-register if you have registered for some of the jackets in the past. So, but we need you to sign up now. The only requirement you have is that you are a veteran. So go to veteransradio.net and click on the jacket and register, and we'll be giving that away on Sunday, the Sunday just before Thanksgiving. So make sure that you do that. The other sponsors I want to make sure that we thank are, of course, our local veteran service organizations, American Legion Post 46, VFW Post 423, and the Charles S. Kettles VVA Post 310, all of Ann Arbor, Michigan. We want to thank you, men and women of those organizations. We couldn't do this program without your help. Couple of upcoming events that are in the local area. By the way, those of you that listen to Veterans Radio out in California and Pennsylvania, if you have an event that you would like us to promote for you, just send us an email at dale@veteransradio.net, or go to our website, veteransradio.net, and click on Contact Us, and we'll be happy to mention it. So I've got a couple of them that are coming up here locally. Number one is a patriotic salute to veterans. That's coming up on Sunday, October 27th, and it is by the Celine New Horizons Band. They present their 15th annual patriotic salute to veterans. This is going to be held at the Celine Middle School, and it begins at 3 o'clock on Sunday, October 27th. That's 3 o'clock Sunday, October 27th, for some great patriotic music presented by the Celine New Horizons Band at Celine Middle School. And that one's free, by the way, so that's kind of a good one to go to. Coming up also on the 30th of October is going to be our next Open Mic for Veterans. This, you know, we kind of entitled this There I Was. Open Mic for Veterans is going to be on Wednesday, October 30th at the VFW 423 Hall down on Wagner Road. It begins at 5:30 p.m., runs till 8 o'clock. This is totally free. The idea here is to get veterans to tell their stories. This month's theme is going to be your first overseas assignment. What did you think about it? Where were you going? And what was your reaction to it? So that's There I Was, Open Mic for Veterans on Wednesday, October 30th at 5:30 at the VFW 423 Hall on Wagner Road, just south of Ann Arbor. Next up is Tribe Talks, and Melissa Engel has been on our program a number of times. She is a veterans counselor and is currently working on her PhD in counseling, and she has a program called Tribe Talks, designed this time for female veterans. It's going to run from November 1st to November 3rd. It's going to be out at Camp Liberty, and what this does is, in this case, it gets women's veterans together, and they kind of have an opportunity to talk about their issues, so their experiences, and Melissa is there to help them work through some of these things for them. They use all types of different therapy, and it's a great, great program, and it's been working well for, I think she's been doing this for about a year now with men and women. So this one is for Tribe Talks for Female Veterans, November 1st to November 3rd. For more information, you can call Melissa direct. It's Melissa Engel. Her number is 586-222-3391. It's 586-222-3391. And then the last thing on our agenda for today is the Stories of Service program is coming to the Michigan Theater on November 6th at 7 p.m., and this is to benefit Fisher House of Michigan. This has been going on for about the last 5 years, if I recall, and it is free for veterans, but they charge civilians $15, and they are counting on selling out the Michigan Theater, and the doors open at 6:30. Program begins at 7 o'clock when 5 veterans will be telling their stories. So you need to go to their website, and that is storiesofservice.org. storiesofservice.org. And again, that is November 6th at the Michigan Theater, beginning at 7 o'clock. Veterans get in for free. There is a VIP reception. For more information, go to storiesofservice.org. Okay. So that takes care of all the business of announcements and so on and so forth. Earlier this week, I recorded an interview with Major General Dana Pittard, the United States Army retired, and Air Force Master Sergeant Wes Bryant. And I called them back on the program because they were they'd written an op-ed for a military news letter called Task and Purpose, where a lot of veterans go to get their information. I was not aware of this site, and we'll hear more about it during the interview. But we recorded this, and there are the authors of the book, Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. And we just thought it was really important that we get these two men back on the program, so I'm going to go to that recorded interview right now. And if you have any questions, you can ask us at the end of the interview. Wes Bryant will be available at that time. And our number here locally, I better give that to you, 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. This is the opinions expressed on this are those of the author and do not reflect the views of Veterans Radio nor your local radio station. So here is Major General Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant. We are here talking with two guests that were on just recently, Major General retired Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant, both retired, but they were the authors of a book entitled Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and on the Dawn of the Strike Cell. And the reason that I asked these two gentlemen to be on the program today is because the book that they wrote talked about the U.S. war, obviously, on ISIS, and with the president's decision last week to not only withdraw our troops, but to kind of hand over the territory to the Turkish people and kind of abandon our allies and the Kurds. And so I'm going to start off with you, General Pittard. What's going on here?
Well, what occurred is that President Trump had a phone call from President Erdogan, and he agreed to move some of our advisors from northern Syria down south. And I think President Trump's intent overall is to move the entire U.S. troop element there, which is around 1,000, out of Syria. And what that ended up doing is allowing the Turkish army then to move through and push and try to push out the Syrian Kurds from areas of northern and northeastern Syria. Now, of course, the Kurds were our allies and played a huge role in helping to defeat the ISIS geographical caliphate in Syria and Iraq, but especially in Syria, the Syrian Kurds. So that's a concern. Now, most up-to-date news is that the U.S. has spoken to Turkey on a temporary pause or ceasefire to allow the Syrian Kurds then to move south. But it's not just their forces that are moving. It's their families, their children, wives, their livelihoods, moving out of towns that they have grown up in. And so it's not like just moving forces south. And I believe that's going to occur for a few days, and then the Turkish army will continue its offensive in creating a buffer zone just south of the Turkish border.
Bless you back. So my question was that the idea was that Syria is south of Turkey, and this 20-mile buffer zone that they've agreed on is going. Where are the Kurds going to go? Which direction do they go? Do they go into Syria? Do they head, I guess, east toward Iraq, Dana?
Well, the Kurds from reports, some are going south under the protection of the Syrian government, which is kind of odd because the Syrian Kurds have fought the Syrian government before, but it's an interesting kind of a detente right now. Some of the Syrian Kurds are going to the Iraqi Kurdish regions, Kurdistan as it's called. So that's where they're going right now. And then the maps, that's one thing in our book, Hunting the Caliphate, we have maps that kind of show the connections. Mm-hmm. There for those who haven't seen the maps.
Well, I guess the main point of asking you to come on today was to find out how you reacted to the president's decision to get out. I mean, you started to, not started, but you were a main influence there in attempting to get ISIS out of that area of the world, and now suddenly it seems like your mission has been postponed or just ended, and you have to walk away. How does that feel to you?
Well, the geographical caliphate of the ISIS has been defeated. But I was disappointed in the decision because the Syrian Kurds were our allies. And though it's been noted that they're not angels, and I got that, and they've had a simmering conflict with Turkey for quite a while. But it's disappointing that we would abandon our Kurdish allies like that.
And West, as an enlisted man, how do you feel about that?
I was truly ashamed. I know some people have used that same word. And I felt it was a forfeiting, really, of American honor, the honor of the American warfighter. I was never a fan of sending troops into Syria initially. We needed to do for the Kurds without having our guys on the ground. But once we do, it changes the dynamics, and they've been there for a few years. So our guys on the ground kept Iranians, Russians, Syrians, and the Turks all away from the Kurds, essentially. Pulling them out, to me, was not the huge issue. Okay, the ISIS caliphate is defeated. Yeah, let's pull them out, and we can continue to support the Kurds against what we know are hundreds of cells of ISIS remaining in Syria, set in the numbers of thousands of ISIS fighters and sympathizers. But doing it combined with, all right, we're pulling them out basically so that Turkey can go ahead and go on an offensive against the Kurds, that was the issue. So when people say, give credit to, frankly, President Trump's decision and say, oh, we were done there, let's pull out, this is their thing now. Well, that's not the whole story. The whole story, yeah, we're allowing one NATO ally to go in against a partner force, which by truly warfighting ethics and just human morality is an ally of sorts, though not technically an ally, right? But our partner force that's lost 11,000 in fighting against a common enemy with us. And to allow those two, to allow one greater power to aggress the other, it should have been, it's not only in our interest, morally, ethically, but also strategically, but it should have been our responsibility to keep that from happening. So it just can't be this, hey, America first and our interests first, we're done. Because to me, that's what separates an imperialist type of nation from one that is using its power for good. You know, I supported special forces, Army Special Forces, and their main motto, their creed, is de oppresso liber, liberate the oppressed.
Liberate the oppressed, right?
And that's really the creed. Yeah. And that can really be applied to our entire military and why we're in most places we are. And so to say, well, we're done with you now. See you later. We beat this enemy. You guys all go have fun. That's just antithetical to, I feel, to our ideals and why we should be overseas and in the Middle East in the first place.
Okay. Dana, what do you see as the political ramifications of this? My understanding is it looks like the you know, Turkey and the Russians and the Iranians are going to be the ones that are going to kind of fill the void.
Oh, yeah, from a geostrategic perspective, yes. And the leverage that we had, part of the leverage that we had was the fact that we had troops on the ground that were separating really the Turkish military from the Syrian Kurds, but also, as Wes just said, also keeping the Russians and Syrians at bay from that area also. That eventually there was going to have to be some kind of settlement, but we were going to be a key player in that settlement. Now, again, there will be a settlement, but most of the leverage that we had, we no longer have. It is now really in the hands of Russia, Turkey, Iran, and Syria. That's the effect. Impact.
I'm not. I was reading your article. Major General Pittard and Master Sergeant Bryant wrote an article, and I don't know the name. Yeah, Task and Purpose. What is Task and Purpose? Either one of you can I give me a background
task and
on that?
It's a pretty widespread military and veteran oriented media source.
Mm-hmm.
I cover primarily what's going on with our wars, and then veterans' issues back home as well. So really on my side, in the war fighting community, the special ops community, everybody knows about Task and Purpose. And I have friends that get most of their news actually from that versus other mainstream media sources.
All right, well, it makes sense.
So it was nice to be picked up.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I looked it up, and now I'm following them a little bit more. It appears that they're pretty apolitical. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. They present... they'll have perspectives from veterans on, both sides of the spectrum, just really looking at veterans' issues and warfighting issues, warfighting policies.
Well, one of the stories that I was reading, in addition to yours, which really makes a whole lot of sense, when one of your comments here is, we've seen this movie before, which I remember, was that, we kind of evacuated, we got out of Iraq rather quickly. For those of us that are my age that fought in the Vietnam War, we got out of Vietnam and didn't keep our promises there that we would always, have their back, and we didn't. And I just think that we are, we're setting precedent again that the American word is not good. Either comments by either one of you on that one?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the scene of the helicopters and whenever it was April 1975 in Saigon, and it was just our way of... We didn't stay there and helped our ally, which was South Vietnam. It took us a long time, I think, to shed that and gain trust from future allies and partner nations. And then in 2011,
I'm sorry.
In 2011, when we left Iraq, it wasn't like we were abandoning anybody necessarily. But I think the Sunnis in some ways eventually felt that way, because after we left, then the Shia Muslim-dominated government led by Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki really started many repressive policies against the Sunni Iraqis,
mm-hmm.
Which helped to give ISIS roots in the Sunni provinces. And then just 3 years later, 2014, we had ISIS.
Right. Yeah, we did. It's interesting because I have a student of mine is from Iraq, and he's saying, we got to talking a little bit about this, and I said, why are you turning to the Iranians? And he says, well, the Iranians are the only ones that are willing to help us right now. And I thought that was a very telling statement, because we're not involved too much there, and the other countries in that area, Turkey, Iran especially, are going to, I think, start exerting a little bit more influence, since we've basically said, well, we're out of here.
I agree. I mean, we must be engaged, and that's got to change. We must be engaged in the region.
Well, it seems like we're willing to help out the Saudis. We're sending more weapons.
Yeah, I think that's been the biggest problem for a lot of Americans, and really and warfighters on both sides of the political spectrum through multiple administrations, is what is our intent? Because it seems to change all the time in the Middle East. And when you circle it back to this particular decision of withdrawing and supposedly ending our endless wars, well, to me, without going into completely creating kind of conspiracy theory, there's at least a little doubt in that, or a lot of doubt in that for me, mm-hmm. in that, why are we not at the same time then talking about withdrawing from the place we've been the longest, which is Afghanistan, in Iraq. So if it was all about just ending the endless war and I'm pulling our guys out because we're done, then that all would be happening right now simultaneously. So to me, there's ulterior motives, and those ulterior motives stem from alignment with various countries, based probably based on dollars. But, you know, I'm not an expert in that realm. It's just, I think that's what a lot of Americans pick up on when they see all this back and forth with these policies in the Middle East. And who faces the repercussions is the good people in the Middle East that don't deserve it, that deserve to, you know, have their partners and allies protect them and back them up. And then also the American warfighter themselves. Mm-hmm. They're constantly yanked back and forth. You got one of the things that made me the most angry about this was he did this in a manner where our guys were being shelled, right, by Turkish artillery, where we had to drop bombs on our own positions to avoid the Russians, our material from being compromised by the Russians. To me, it's just reprehensible for a commander-in-chief to do. And I just really don't care what, you know, if it was a guy that I loved and voted for previously, I'd be saying the same thing. But I had a lot to say about the last administration as well in these regards.
Well, I think, you know, 19 years, we have not really had it seemed like a plan at all. And just kind of, well, that's just our personal opinion, right, Wes? You know, it gets very frustrating. Yeah. And I know that General Pétard probably has a little bit more information than you or I do when it comes to, you know, what was really going on over there. And I know that you cannot share all that information with us as much as we would love to hear it, right?
Well, I would just say that each administration has had a plan. It may not have been executed as well as the administration wanted it to, but they all had plans. And that's what's and with some level of end states. It was a head scratcher in 2011 when President Obama agreed to all U.S. forces leaving. So, again, what was the end state we were looking for there? Just like it was a head scratcher with President Trump withdrawing U.S. forces from Syria. What is the end game? What do we hope to achieve by doing that? So that's part of the problem is when decisions are made, looking out at the second and third effects and looking out to see, does this help us with our overall strategic goals and objectives in the region? And I'm not sure that was done with that decision.
You got to wonder who's giving him advice and you know, which advice he listens to. We know that he goes a lot on instincts, and you know, maybe many of us don't quite understand those instincts. One of my questions was how do you think that this withdrawal is affecting the morale of the American troops, not only in the Middle East but around the world?
I think it's for those who've worked with the Syrian Kurds, in some ways it's devastating because these are people that they work with. They looked him in the eye. We've been partnered, allies, or whatever the term we're going to use, for the past few years. So for those who have been there in the region, I think it's not only disappointing but devastating. But for American troops around the world, I'll say it has less effect, with the exception of the partner forces that they're working with in other areas around the world and other regions might question whether or not there's enough American resolve to help them in a pinch. But I don't think it'll impact too much on our troops in other areas. It's just my opinion. Wes, I know you have an opinion yourself.
Yeah, I think, no, I always like, Dana always kind of brings me back to the center when we have these discussions. But I will say it doesn't affect the warfighting capability by any means. It does affect the morale, even for guys that may agree with in some way or sympathize with Trump's decisions here. But the American warfighter is really, in the last 20 years, they're frankly used to being to administrations going back and forth on policy. One day we're bombing in Afghanistan and we're doing going on full offensives and night raids, and the next day we're locked in our bases and our camps and we're not allowed to do anything but humanitarian ops, right? Same thing happened in Iraq to an extent. Same thing happened in the war on ISIS over the years in different capacities. But we just know it. The warfighters generally learn really quick that things can change on a whim. Directives can change, and they're used to adapting to that. Yeah, it does. But it does definitely piss people off, and, you know, it can lead to disgruntledness. I think one thing, maybe that's something we have to learn to accept as a civilian-controlled military. So there's that aspect. One thing we should never accept, though, is decisions that put our people in harm's way unduly, as what happened with the withdrawal. in Syria, and the Turks coming close to hitting our guys. It reminded me of 2014 when we pushed into Iraq, and our crisis response force, that small team of special operators on the Baghdad airport, getting rocketed by ISIS within kilometers of their positions, and being told that, oh, you're under authorization from the State Department. We're not under combat authorization, so we can't go out and do counteroffensives. You also, by the way, you can't have any air support. So our guys were just sitting there getting rocketed and couldn't do anything about it, right? It reminded me of that.
Well, it certainly would remind probably everybody out there. The articles that I've been reading is that especially our special forces troops, Rangers and SEALs and so forth, that kind of, go in and out of areas, hopefully with nobody finding out they're even there, are concerned by this. And I think it's reflects upon what you said, that, these other operations around the world where we're working with various, guerrilla groups or anti-government forces or whatever, anti-regime, let's put it that way, forces that, can they depend upon us to deliver on our word? And I think that's the main thing that I see occurring around here. I mean, we realize, and all three of us realize that, the military doesn't make the decisions on where to go. It's when we're there that we do the best that we can and, get in, get out as fast as we can and do our job. Mm. You agree with that one?
Mm. Yes, exactly. And bringing it back to the role of our special operations as a whole, but especially Army Special Forces, which were created to go in and form friendships, partnerships, trust with, indigenous guerrilla forces. It just destroys that mission set, really, at least in that part of the world, and at least with the Kurds right now. But when our guys go into other parts of the world who have watched this play out, right? Because everybody's got access to news, even in the far reaches of the world. How much less are they going to trust that special forces team that comes in and says, hey, we're your friends, we're going to help you.
Right. And we've been talking here with Major General Dana Pittard and Master Sergeant Wes Bryant, who were involved in they started the war against ISIS. And now we're just talking about what is going on. And I guess my last question for each of you here as we wrap this up is, what do you see as the future over the next, let's say, the next 6 months? General Pittard, what do you think is next?
Well, I think it's going to be some level of settlement between Turkey, Russia, and Syria, and in some ways the Syrian Kurds. And Iran will have a piece of it in settling northern and northeastern Syria. What the Russians and the Iranians are helping the Syrians do, though, is to put down all the insurgent groups and defeat all the insurgent groups that are fighting against President Bashar Assad. So we'll continue to see that. But this could, in fact, cause a settlement to take place in that area. It's just not fortuitous for U.S. interests on how that's being done.
Well, it doesn't sound like we even want to be consulted.
Yeah, which is too bad, because we are a player there, whether we want to or not. But we just kind of cashed in some of our poker chips, so we're not going to have a whole lot of leverage at the table if we've been invited to the table.
Okay. We recorded that interview earlier in the week, and I've got Wes Bryant is on the line right now because I didn't get a chance to answer him that question the other day. So, Wes, welcome back to Veterans Radio. With some of the changes or some of the news that has occurred over the last couple of days, where do you see this all going in the next 6 months?
Yeah, what I was going to finish with is on my end, too, you've got the aspect of ISIS resurging. It had been reported by numerous, sources and intelligent analysts over the last few months that ISIS has already actually been resurging, even before this happened, in Syria by way of small cells, a few man cells proliferated everywhere throughout Syria. And you've got, by the way, Al-Qaeda in western Syria resurging as well. So, what is fueled by the chaos of something like we have in Syria? Radicalism. ISIS came out of that chaos back in 2013. And I don't see that stopping. I see that coming up in some way. I can't really predict when or in what capacity, but I don't think this is going to serve our campaign against ISIS well at all. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and the news today is that those 1,000 troops that were in Syria are being moved to western Iraq.
Yes, that's back to what I said earlier in the program where, mm-hmm. you know, this line of ending all wars and bringing our troops back home kind of thing, it's really a half-truth at the most. It's just realigning troops back to where you want to focus them, you know, which is in this case, in western Iraq. So it serves to just expose that, what we'll call lie, half-truth, maybe ignorance on his part when he makes a statement like that about the decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, Wes, I want to thank you very much for being on the program, recorded and live, and I look forward to talking to you, both you and the general, again in the next couple of weeks to see what else is going on in the Middle East. So thank you very much for your time, Wes.
Me too. Thanks so much, Del.
All righty. All right. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we will be back with our resident expert on foreign policy everywhere around the world, Dr. Rebecca Grant. So we're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position. But then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We're back on Veterans Radio on this Sunday afternoon, and we're talking about, well, many things, particularly about the Middle East and the withdrawal of American troops out of Syria and all that that goes on with that. And my guest right now is our resident expert and military historian, Dr. Rebecca Grant, author, commentator, and she's the president of IRISC Independent Research. Just to remind everybody, she is a national security analyst based in Washington, D.C. She earned her Ph.D. in international relations, worked for the RAND Corporation, was on the staff of the Secretary of the Air Force and Chief of Staff of the Air Force. If there's anything going on in the world, I think Dr. Grant knows all about it. So, Dr. Grant, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Glad to be here. And, yes, there is a lot going on in the world, isn't there, Dale?
Wow. And you know, we just had a general and master sergeant on that were talking about their experiences in Syria and fighting ISIS over there and their reactions to the withdrawal. And so I guess I'm going to ask you, what is your reaction to President Trump's decision?
Well, you know, first, I just have to take a moment and say how glad I am that you had them on, because especially the master sergeant, who is an air controller, that's such an important part of our military, and I'm delighted that he was featured. You know, my reaction on the withdrawal, one is you could have seen this one coming. President Trump started talking back in April of 2018 about, hey, it's about time to start pulling these troops out. Interesting. From a military history standpoint, is it was actually Trump who increased the number of forces on the ground in Syria. Mm-hmm. Secretary of Defense Mattis, back in the summer of 2017, went to President Trump with a proposal to say, hey, let's put a few more of our elite forces, kind of like Master Sergeant Bryant, forward, and give them a new set of orders so they can coach the coalition a little more and wrap up the defeat ISIS. And that worked really well. The Kurds were obviously a part of that, but it's a big coalition, 81 members. They took Raqqa back 2 years ago, and that was the capital of the so-called ISIS caliphate. It fell in October of 2017. And really, after that, it kind of slipped out of the headlines, but you started to see Mattis and others talking about, let's try to untangle and take back some of the heavy weaponry and start to move things along. So, you know, it seemed a little abrupt, but honestly, it had been brewing for quite some time. It was the Turkish offensive and the Turks absolutely losing patience that made that withdrawal urgent, as we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned in our emails back and forth this week that you wanted to talk about the Syrian town of Kobani.
Yes, Kobani. It just sums up what the situation there. And, you know, Dale, we have to remember this is part of a tragic ongoing Syrian civil war. It was really difficult with the Obama administration. They struggled with it for years. Susan Rice, who was Obama's national security advisor, just came out with a book, and she wrote about the struggles and the debates and the $6 billion that they spent. Anyway, it all came to a focus in this border town of Kobani, which back in 2012, Syrian rebels took from Assad's government forces. And then ISIS moved in the 2013-2014 time frame. Same time, ISIS moved down towards Baghdad and set up that huge geographic caliphate. Mm-hmm. And so Obama and Secretary of State Kerry made the decision to go into Syria as well as fighting against ISIS in Iraq. And a lot of our European allies said, hey, no, we're not doing Syria right now. We'll help you with Iraq, but Syria, not yet. That all changed in 2015 after the Paris bombings. But the town of Kobani, at this time 5 years ago, was under siege. ISIS had surrounded it. They wanted it for symbolic reasons. And the U.S. used massive air power, controlled by JTACs and others, and allied with this small group of Syrian Kurds that called themselves the YPG. They were eventually renamed the Syrian Defense Forces with a little marketing help from U.S. Special Forces Command. And after dropping so many bombs, you know, 100,000 bombs have been dropped in that ISIS war, and a bunch of those went into Kobani. The B-1 bombers were very active there for about a six-month period. Civilians had been evacuated. So finally, the coalition with the SDF forces in the lead took Kobani again. And last week, Assad's forces took it back.
Right.
And it's sort of just the sad sum up of that Syrian civil war.
I emotionally, I guess I understand the reasoning for getting out of that area, and I'm trying to make it an intellectual decision as well. As General Petard pointed out, he says we've kind of given up our chair at the table when it comes to negotiating. You know, he sees a negotiated ceasefire or divvying up of the property and land and so forth around there, you know, with the Russians involved, probably Turkey, Iran, but he says he doesn't know where our place is going to be next. What do you think about that?
That's interesting how he phrases that, and I think that captures how many other nations are in there. Of course, Russia, you know, Putin really waited after the Obama administration didn't act in 2013. He kind of bided his time, and then, as we know, went in and established two big military bases there and refreshed all of Assad's heavy weaponry. Turkey, of course, remains very involved. And the fact is that Russia and Turkey and sometimes Iran have been meeting with the Syrians for a long time. You know, even back in the Obama years, it was a Russian broker deal to move out supposedly all the chemical weapons. It turned out to be all, but a lot of chemical weapons were moved out. So I think, you know, we kind of lost that seat at the table quite a while ago. The other fact is that the main objective of having U.S. forces there was originally to prevent ISIS taking over Iraq, and then it was to lead the Defeat ISIS Coalition, which is still there, and which achieved its objective. They broke up that geographical caliphate. That happened over a year ago, and that was the main military objective. You know, what I've observed, too, is that none of our European partners wanted to get re-involved in this northeastern corner of Syria. We've kind of known for quite some time, while we conducted through the coalition some final operations there, we've known that this was going to be hard to settle. And I think there was hope that it would be settled without the type of conflict that we've seen. But in fact, that didn't come to pass.
Mm-hmm. There's a big meeting coming up with NATO in this week, actually. And so that should be rather interesting, don't you think?
Oh, definitely, because, you know, NATO is one of the 81 members of the Defeat ISIS Coalition, mostly its countries, but there are a few international organizations like NATO that are involved. And, of course, the key players there. You know, remember, Dale, it was France that controlled Syria after World War II. France mm-hmm. still has forces there, but all the Defeat ISIS Coalition forces up in that corner have been very dependent on two items. And one is U.S. logistical support. The other, of course, is coalition air power, which involves other countries, but it's U.S.-led. Now, the air power remains there, and we've heard some reports about F-15Es taking out ammunition dumps and other things. So the decision to pull back means that really the whole rest of the coalition force needs to come out. Now, Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, who is former Army and fought in the Gulf War, so he knows what he's talking about, he said that this is going to be done over a period, you know, a gradual period. And as far as I can tell, it looks like they are keeping the little base down at, on the southern part of that kind of triangle, which has been used as sort of really more of a forward rearming point more than a base, I think would describe mm-hmm. it accurately. So they'll keep that. But there's no question, you know, this is a big change. On the other hand, Dale, I mean, I've got to say, if you look at it from the larger perspective, you have to say, what were a few forces going to be able to do in that situation? The first little group that came out, the 50 to 100, were forces that were doing joint patrols with Turkey. They were dismantling some of the SDF/YPG, Syrian Kurd, emplacements, fortifications, trying to take back some heavy weaponry, and doing these joint patrols with Turkey. That was the first element that the president asked to have pulled back, and I think that was the correct decision. Apparently, Esper and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, U.S. Army, had been on the phone with Turkey for a long time prior to this offensive and saying, hey, don't do it. Turkey said, you know what, we're going to do it anyway. So they had to do that. All of these things are going to be discussed at the NATO meeting. Turkey, of course, is a NATO ally, and so I think we'll see quite a bit of discussion here. And the question is going to be, is Turkey willing, now that they've done their offensive, have the ceasefire, are they willing to be responsible partners in a security mechanism on that Syrian border? That's the big question.
Right, yes. And I know that many of the veterans that I know and I've been talking to from this generation, their concern is about the civilians on the ground. You know, as we mentioned in our earlier interview, when you go into these places, not only do you want to get rid of the bad guys, you want to try and win the hearts and minds of the local population so that, you know, they help you with intelligence and so on and so forth. And I think that that's one of the things that upset, I know it upset West the most, was that, you know, without warning that, you know, we decided that we were going to get out. But let's move a little bit further to the east and get into Afghanistan.
And Afghanistan, yes.
See what's happening there. Secretary of Defense Esper was there, and he's, I guess he's going to follow through on the cut the troop levels to 8,600 Americans.
That's what he's talking about. Yes, the Secretary of Defense made a trip to Afghanistan. They always make them unannounced trips, right? They
Right.
They announce when they're on the ground. He went to Afghanistan and then will be heading, you know, kind of hopscotching back towards the NATO meeting and then coming home sometime after that. So as we recall, they were very close to a phase one of a peace deal, which was essentially negotiations between the U.S. and the Taliban. And these negotiations have gone on all over the place. A lot of them take place in Qatar. They've had some in Moscow, and our U.S. special envoy, Zamaneh Khalilzad, who is Afghan by birth and American citizen, former U.N. ambassador, great diplomat. They were very, very close to an agreement that would have looked at a type of ceasefire in Afghanistan and then gone to a phase two, which was working with Afghanistan's government to set the next set of conditions and hopefully lead to withdrawal. So going down to 8,600, Dale, another interesting point here is, again, this is President Trump taking back forces that he had deployed. So just as I said, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis talked the president into increasing forces in Syria just a little bit, and it worked really well. So then he said, well, let's try the same strategy in Afghanistan. Let's put a little more air power back over there. Let's increase the forces so we can assist the Afghans against the Taliban and the others that are there. And let's try it. And President Trump, very reluctant, not unlike what President Obama faced making similar decisions. He said, all right, give it a try. Now, unfortunately, didn't work quite as cleanly in Afghanistan because while the fighting continued, the Taliban still has control of a pretty big swath of it. And, Dale, I looked up the statistics. There were more bombs dropped in Afghanistan in September than in any single month for 6 years. So a lot of U.S., again, coalition activity going on there. So Esper was there to meet with Afghanistan's President Ghani, I think to kind of get a feel for the status of Afghanistan's security forces, to see where they might go if they resume talks that the president called off. And then I think he's ready to move some forces out. And, again, these are forces that were sent there in 2017 as augmentation. Mm-hmm. They'll come back. Again, no question, but what will keep a fair number of forces there, plus the reach of U.S.-led air power and special forces as well.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't know. I was brought up in that if you break it, you own it, and so then you got to fix it. And it's 19 years in, and we still haven't been able to fix it yet. So I don't know how they're going to get out of it. But I'm sure that hopefully somewhere in my lifetime that we'll be able to get out of there.
I agree. The plan, the loose plan, was to build up Afghanistan's security forces and their air force so that they could do their own security against those elements. And, you know, whether this is good or bad, this is what the plan was. We've sold them quite a lot of military equipment, including helicopters, et cetera, really worked on training the air force, and that was the hope. It worked in Iraq. It took years, but it worked in Iraq. Don't know about Afghanistan, and I think the president is very keen to find a way out, and I think with 2020 elections coming up, he would really like to be able to say, I got us out of Afghanistan. So, long ways to go still.
I agree. All right, so the last subject for today is going to be China, and they just like to get themselves involved in a lot of things going on over here. So what's the next thing that they're up to?
So interesting with China. You know, Dale, we've talked on the program about their military bases in the South China Seas, mm-hmm. about some of their advanced technology. They had their big anniversary of the People's Revolution on October 1st and had a parade with some unbelievable missiles. And they actually, what was interesting is for the first time, China said, you know, we can nuke New York.
Great.
I mean, it was the Koreans, the North Koreans, you wouldn't even pay attention. But China has not done a lot of that declaratory doctrine. We knew that they could, but it was interesting to me. And they published a map showing four places, including, like, I don't know, Long Island and Persephone, and where they were going to put the... It was a very, very undiplomatic, very aggressive move. It tied to their big anniversary. So the military is continuing. But the other layer, of course, are the tariffs. And then there's sort of a third layer, and that is awareness of the extent to which China has seeped into American society in places like Silicon Valley and the venture capital, and even in Hollywood. So I want to tell you about the Hollywood piece real quickly. There's a film out by Quentin Tarantino who did Pulp Fiction years ago, and this is his Brad Pitt film. And it was to be distributed in China because films make a lot of money overseas, right? Well, the Chinese didn't like some of the scenes, and they wanted Quentin Tarantino to go back and edit it. And Sony Pictures said, oh, my gosh, what do we do? And Quentin Tarantino says, no, in my contract, I have director's cut, and I will not change this movie to Chinese. And Secretary of State Pompeo said on Twitter, good going, Quentin Tarantino. So it's just a small example of how China is pushing globally to have it be all their story. We've seen a lot of that with Hong Kong, with the controversies with the NBA. And China wants to push their version of events, their reality, and their rules. And I'm glad to see Hollywood pushing back.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't mess around when somebody's filmed. Many of the directors I've ever had to work with, you don't mess with them. It's like they're babies. You mentioned also that they are kind of seeping into our universities. You mentioned Silicon Valley. You're setting up computer systems for other NATO allies.
Yes, and again, this is sort of this third wave of awareness about the permeation of China. That, you know, we know it's gone on in trade over the last 20 years. And remember, Dale, the whole idea was let China into the Western trading system. They'll become more like us, more democratic freedoms, and they'll respect intellectual property and live up to their commitments. Well, it just didn't quite work out.
Right.
And all the pieces of that. So the FBI has started urging universities to monitor some of the Chinese students. Turns out a lot of the Chinese students at American universities are on scholarships from the People's Liberation Army, which is the army there. And they'll often participate in research. And I think there was a big kind of open arms, typical, you know, American generosity and all this, but now the FBI has said, you might want to just check because some of these students may have connections back to the Chinese military and other sources. With the NATO allies, this is about the big tech company of China called Huawei. They want to set up 5G wireless, and they are looking at Portugal, and Britain has said, no, we won't do it. But they are trying kind of one by one to pick through the NATO allies. And our supreme commander of NATO is now General Todd Walters, Air Force, has testified to Congress about the need to really watch this. And if you have too many Huawei devices set up in your national emergency response system, it could corrupt the data and allow the potential Chinese intrusion in time of emergency. Very bad. Don't want to see that happen.
Well,
the final area is Silicon Valley. Turns out there's been a lot of Chinese venture capital running around, and now Silicon Valley is paying a little bit closer attention to where some of that cash is coming from.
Well, you consider that, you know, so many of our devices are made in China or, you know, in that part of the world. It's not that difficult to, you know, stretch your imagination and say, okay, they're already here.
Yes, they're already here. I think that really is true. And, you know, certainly Huawei and others would say, oh, well, we would never do that. But from a planning perspective, you have to look at the worst case, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the worst case is software is never secure. If you are plugged into something and there's a Chinese-made device, we know Huawei is owned by several very mysterious holding corporations that go right back to the Chinese Communist Party. So there's a potential there, and we have to be careful about that because certainly the Chinese have proved that they are masters of cyber espionage, and they love to hack into things, and that they can potentially do that. We don't want that in our domestic emergency response, and certainly we don't want that in any of our national security-related networks.
No, not at all. Dr. Rebecca Grant, again, thank you again, as usual. I would really like to have you back on and talk more about that security of our devices and computer security and so on and so forth, and hope you'll be willing to come back and talk about that. Maybe you have an expert, as you know, that we could bring on with you.
Great. I'd love to talk more about that. Thank you very much, Dale.
Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, we're coming up on the end of our program again today. We want to thank you all very much, but we'd like to get your comments about today's program. So if you please go to our website, click on Contact Us, let us know what you thought about today's program, what you would like to hear in the future, what subjects you think are important, and maybe what stories you would like to hear all about. While you're there, you also will find the link to our monthly U.S. Wings flight jacket giveaway, our special U.S. Wings flight jacket giveaway in November, which is the $800 Top Gun jacket, which is really an awesome one. Just go to uswings.com, and it's prominently displayed on their front page. Finally, we really do appreciate all the support that we've been getting from all of you out there. We're always seeking support from patriots like you to help us keep the website and social media up and running, as well as a cost association with just doing a radio broadcast. You'll find a PayPal button on the homepage for those of you who are inspired to help us out, and we want to thank you all very much for your support in advance. Coming up next week is our program on benefits, so we need you to, again, send us emails or click on the Contact Us. Any of the benefit questions you have regarding disability benefits or also veterans health care, because we're going to have a guest next week, hopefully, is going to talk about how the new Veterans Choice Program is working with the urgent care clinics that are out and around and which ones we can use and which ones we can't. So we want to thank you all for listening to Veterans Radio today. Until next week, this is Dale Thronberry saying you are dismissed.